Matthew's Gospel, chapter 26, verse 36. We're following Jesus through the last 48 hours of his life, from the start of Matthew chapter 26, where he concludes his teaching, announces to his disciples that the Passover is coming, which of course for him means that he will become the Passover lamb who takes away the sin of the world, who takes away death from his people. And so these two or three chapters of Matthew's Gospel, 26 and 27 and into 28, describe these last couple of days of Jesus' life. And we read, well, it was 2 weeks ago, because I was away in Eaglesham last week, 2 weeks ago, we read about the Lord's Supper, the Last Supper, where Jesus shared bread and wine as his body and blood and predicted Peter's denial. And that passage ended with them leaving the upper room and heading out to the Mount of Olives to spend the night. And that's where the story picks up this morning in verse 36. And then Jesus went with his disciples to a place called Gethsemane. And he said to them, "Sit here while I go over there and pray." And he took Peter and the two sons of Zebedee along with him, and he began to be sorrowful and troubled. And then he said to them, "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. Stay here and keep watch with me." And going a little further, he fell with his face to the ground and prayed, "My Father, if it is possible, may this cup be taken from me. Yet not as I will, but as you will." Then he returned to his disciples and found them sleeping. "Couldn't you men keep watch with me for 1 hour?" he asked Peter. "Watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak." And he went away a second time and prayed, "My Father, if it's not possible for this cup to be taken away unless I drink it, may your will be done." When he came back, he again found them sleeping because their eyes were heavy. So he left them and went away once more and prayed the third time, saying the same thing. And then he returned to the disciples and said to them, "Are you still sleeping and resting? Look, the hour has come, and the Son of Man is delivered into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us go. Here come my betrayer." While he was still speaking, Judas, one of the 12, arrived. And with him was a large crowd armed with swords and clubs sent from the chief priests and the elders of the people. Now the betrayer had arranged a signal with them, "The one I kiss is the man. Arrest him." Going at once to Jesus, Judas said, "Greetings, Rabbi," and kissed him. Jesus replied, "Do what you came for, friend." Then the men stepped forward, seized Jesus, and arrested him. And with that, one of Jesus' companions reached for his sword, drew it out, and struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his ear. "Put your sword back in its place," Jesus said to him, "for all who draw the sword will die by the sword. Do you think I cannot call on my Father, and he will at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels? But how then would the scriptures be fulfilled that say it must happen in this way?" And in that hour, Jesus said to the crowd, "Am I leading a rebellion that you have come out with swords and clubs to capture me? Every day I sat in the temple courts teaching, and you did not arrest me. But this has all taken place that the writings of the prophets might be fulfilled." And then all the disciples deserted him and fled. Amen. And I pray that God will follow with his blessing this reading from his word. I wonder what kinds of thing in life make you feel anxious. What causes you anxiety? For some people, it's maybe awaiting the result of an important exam. Your access to university or your next job depends on it. Maybe sometimes, for all of us, it's something like the prospect of a difficult conversation. Maybe you've had a fight with someone and you're going to have to talk to them again the next day, or maybe you're going to have to challenge your boss or someone who works with you about something difficult. Or maybe it's one of those big life events that comes from time to time. You're going to move house or change jobs or something like that. And there's so much to be done and so much that's unknown. Or for some folks, it's maybe walking into a room full of strangers. They're all going to turn and look at you and wonder who you are and why you're there. And you'll have to make small talk with folks you don't know. Or maybe you're one of those folks that gets anxious sitting in a doctor's waiting room because you don't know what's wrong with you, or maybe you do. Or maybe it's in a plane about to take off. Whatever it is, there's all sorts of times when, because of the unexpected or because of the undesirable or because of things that are beyond our control, we feel anxious. Maybe somebody talking about anxiety on a Sunday morning makes you feel anxious because it brings it all back to you and you're reliving the tension now. If that's the case with you, hang on, it'll be all right by the end of the sermon, okay? How do people look when they're anxious? How can you tell if someone is anxious? Or when you stare in the mirror after that sleepless night, what do you look like in the morning? Yeah, the look on our faces, or the unnatural tone of voice in which folks speak because their throat is tight, or wringing their hands or pacing up and down anxiously. People clamming up and not talking at all, or talking endlessly because they can't stop, or shouting instead of maintaining self-control, or even becoming aggressive or doing uncharacteristically silly or dangerous things. Knot in our stomach, a feeling of physical sickness, heart thumping, palms sweating, sore head. It's a deeply disturbing experience to have. And it very often rocks us completely and knocks us for six. Well, that's what Jesus is doing here. He's suffering deep anxiety in the Garden of Gethsemane. Verse 37 says that he was sorrowful and troubled. And apparently Matthew is using Greek words there, which the scholars say describe the confused, restless, half-distracted state produced by mental distress. And that agrees with what Matthew goes on to say: my soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. And Luke tells us in his gospel, chapter 22, verse 44, his sweat fell to the ground like drops of blood. So this is Jesus in turmoil. We know that regularly Jesus went off on his own to pray, and I suppose we don't really know what it was like for him then, but this time we get the details, and there's a real insight into someone who is absolutely shell-shocked, deeply disturbed at the situation that he's in. And of course we know why that is. He talks about this cup which is in front of him, which is a cup of suffering, a bitter-tasting cup to be drunk. And that cup contains his crucifixion. He's just come from a meal where he shared with his friends the news that his body was going to be broken and his blood was going to be shed. And that's at least the fourth time that he has predicted his fate. And what this turmoil, this anguish that he experiences now does, it shows us the impact on him of that knowledge. We sometimes ask the question, why did Jesus have to die? And our question is up there and out there somewhere. What was the theological reason why the death of the Son of Man was necessary? But for Jesus, it's right in here. He's saying, why does this have to happen? Because he's bitter and angry and sad and disturbed and pain-filled at the prospect. And I think that's important for us to see. Jesus has gone to lengths to make sure he was seen in this state. And Matthew and all the other gospel writers record it to help us to understand this, that whatever advantages Jesus enjoyed as a miracle worker who could do anything, as a future-seeing prophet who knew everything, as someone with a mind totally in tune with God's will, always knowing what the end result will be and always understanding why it had to happen. None of that short circuits the pain of the prospect that awaits him. And so what we see here is the anxiety of undiluted humanity. And what Jesus experiences in this situation, the way he feels about it, is exactly the same what you would feel and I would feel if we were put in the same position. Being the Son of God didn't make this any different for him at all. So what are we meant to do with this passage? Well, perhaps the first useful thing to say is this, that anxiety is not a sin. It's not wrong to be anxious. Because if Jesus was worried about what he didn't want to happen to him, then it can't be wrong for us to worry about what we don't want to happen to us, because Jesus was without sin. So that is the first important lesson, that when we get anxious, we shouldn't compound the problem by feeling guilty too. You know, if I was a proper Christian, I wouldn't be worried about this because I'd have more faith in God. We shouldn't feel stupid because we're anxious, or we shouldn't feel ashamed as if somehow greater faith would have gained more self-control and eliminated the problem. Because if we beat ourselves up about that and condemn ourselves for feeling anxious, well, then we're condemning Jesus too. How dare you feel like that in the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus? Pull yourself together. So anxiety is not a sin, and it's better to let Jesus share our anxiety as he shared his. First of all, with his friends, watch with me, and then with his Father. But then we need to balance that by saying anxiety is not an excuse. We all suffer from it, but that doesn't mean that any of us needs to give in to it. We don't need to let it take control. And by that, I'm not at all trying to minimize its impact, and I'm certainly not saying to folk, snap out of it. But neither do we surrender to its tyranny. Sometimes you hear that being done. It's maybe reported in the press after a court case that, yes, the defending counsel says my client did commit this crime, but, you know, he just split up with his girlfriend. Or he had financial worries to deal with, or things were not going well at work, he just lost his job, and that explains the criminal behavior. What Jesus does here deliberately is acts on his anxiety. He's anxious, and he knows what to do about it. And that mental anguish leads him into these 3 hours of prayer as he sorts things out with his Father. Now think about that, 3 hours of prayer. Most of us find 3 minutes of prayer pretty hard to complete without getting distracted. The point is not that we need to time our prayers as if somehow we exchange hours in communion with God for amounts of anxiety relieved, but rather that we recognize that affliction of disturbed minds when it comes, and we allow it to lead us into prayer, knowing that otherwise it will lead to lost faith and disobedient acts. And instead of letting that happen and using our anxiety as an excuse afterwards, we bring the anxiety to God first and keep going for how long? Well, as long as Jesus did. That is, until it was gone. So anxiety is not an excuse. In fact, quite the opposite. Anxiety is an opportunity. See, Jesus knew long before he got to Gethsemane what was going to happen to him, didn't he? Not least at the Last Supper, my body broken and my blood shed. So what's happening here in the garden is not, it's not Jesus discovering his faith, his fate, rather. It's not that an angel suddenly whispered in his ear, you're going to die tonight. And it's not even Jesus really coming to a crossroads, a decision making, will I go through with this or not? Because although some of the language is of that sort, the reality is that Jesus' fate was set. He was born to die, and all of that is decided. What is really happening here is that Jesus is coming to terms with what he knows has to happen. Compare, for example, a child getting married. The engagement has been announced and the whole family has celebrated the news together in 6 months or 12 months. The wedding will take place. Everyone's got together and planned the wedding and helped out. It's right up there in the center of everybody's attention. And yet still at that moment when the vows are being exchanged at the front of the church, there are both parents. You see, I'm being deliberately non-sexist here. There are both parents with tears streaming down their faces. Not because they didn't know what was going to happen when they went to church that afternoon. And not because they would have it any other way. Neither parent would interrupt and say, no, I can't bear this. Don't let it happen. But nevertheless, there's still something deeply emotional going on, which is the reality of this little girl growing up and moving away. And that's what's happening here for Jesus. The reality is sinking in. He already knew it was going to happen, but here he feels it. And probably the clue that confirms that more than anything, if you like, is the combination of the long time and the short prayer. You see the words of the prayer in verse 39, my Father, if it is possible, may this cup be taken from me, but not as I will, but as you will. How do you pray that prayer for an hour? How do you spin it out? Do you say the words really slowly? You say them again and again and again. The disciples fell asleep, probably near the start of it, but when they were woken up again, Jesus was still saying the same thing. In verse 42, my Father, if it's not possible for this cup to be taken away unless I drink it, may your will be done. And then again in verse 44, for the third hour, the same thing. So he goes over it and over it again and again repeatedly until the anxiety passes. And that's what changes here. It's not that Jesus is praying for something to happen and he keeps praying until it does. It's not that he is looking for an answer and he keeps praying until he gets it. It's that he is praying about the answer he already knows and keeps praying until he accepts it. Michael Wilkins says, Jesus found peace in the Garden of Gethsemane as he rested in obedience to his Father's will, in spite of knowing that his worst battles were still to come. Look at the result. This is one of my favorite bits of the Bible story. When you look at the result, 3 hours Jesus spends hiding in the bushes, a confused, restless, weeping wreck of a man. And then afterwards he strides out to confront his enemies, confident, committed, and self-controlled. It's as if this was a musical performance and God has written this score for the way the music has to be played, the writings of the prophets fulfilled in verse 56. And all these other people around about him, they are the musicians, each playing their parts, the disciples, the traitor, the priests, the elders, the crowd of armed guards who came to get him. All of these folks have their parts to play, but the conductor who is timing it all is Jesus. In absolute fingertip control of everything that happens. To his disciples in verse 46, rise, let us go. To Judas in verse 50, do what you have come for. To Peter in verse 52, put your sword back in its place. To all of them in verse 52, you know I could call on angels, but I'm not going to. To the crowd in verse 55, you could have had me in the temple any day, but here I am anyway. You don't need those swords and clubs. This time and for the last time, Jesus is in complete control. From here on in, he will be the victim. Decisions will be taken by other men about him, his trial judges, the ruling politicians, the crucifying soldiers, even the benevolent burial party decide what to do with him. But here, for one last time, Jesus strides onto center stage. John tells us in his gospel, chapter 18, verse 6, that when Jesus spoke, they all drew back and fell to the ground, as if they were worshipping the man they had come to arrest. Such a bold, imposing, commanding performance, even as he puts himself into his hands, because when he was so anxious that he almost couldn't walk and couldn't talk and couldn't speak, he took his anxiety and took the time to put himself in the hands of God. So you see, anxiety, when it comes, is not a problem. Quite the opposite, in fact. If you're one of life's worriers, then that's a gift from God. And you don't need to apologize for it. What you need to do is use your anxiety in the way that Jesus did to equip yourselves and perhaps to equip other people for what's coming. Because if you're worried about it, then you are ready to become better equipped than anyone else to deal with it. So anxiety is not the problem. The problem is not being anxious enough, like the disciples. Now, on a first reading, we might be tempted to sympathize with the disciples. It had, after all, been a long day. They'd had a big meal, taken with wine, and it's now a late night. Falling asleep comes naturally. But then read the story carefully, the way Matthew has written it, and you see what has happened. Jesus has given them a specific command. In verse 38, stay here and keep watch with me. And they have probably never seen him in this state of mind before. Clearly something is up with him. Clearly something demands their attention. So when he comes back in verse 41 to find them sleeping, he doesn't shrug his shoulders and say, well, I suppose, poor souls, they were tired. He says, watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. Now, when you go to your bed at the end of a long day and fall asleep at night, you're not succumbing to temptation. It's tiredness. But Jesus says here, watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. And so the problem is not their tiredness, but their complacency. They're not anxious enough. Putting it bluntly, they don't care. And that's the problem, and so their falling asleep is a sin. And so we come in the second half of that verse, verse 41, to one of those sayings which has become a part of our daily life. In verse 41, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. And such is the influence of the Bible in our language and culture that that phrase has now become like an independent proverb. People use it who've never read the gospel stories and don't know where it comes from. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. But if you look it up, as I did last night, in any compendium or dictionary or reference book or whatever, then it will give you a definition, something like this. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak means people cannot do what they want to. That's one definition. Or another one, human frailty makes it impossible. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak, and that was why they couldn't stay awake. Do you see how that is exactly the opposite of what Jesus means? You see, he's not here explaining to his disciples why they couldn't have stayed awake. It was simply beyond them. He is saying to his disciples that they should have stayed awake because that was what is expected of them. It's not that Jesus woke them up and they said, oh, sorry, Jesus, we didn't mean to fall asleep. And he said, it's all right, I know you tried hard, but the flesh was weak. It's that they should have stayed awake, and Jesus rebukes them and tells them that what they've done was unacceptable. The problem is not that they have weak flesh, because the whole point of this is that they have the same flesh as he has. The problem is that they failed to use their willing spirits to overcome that weakness. The weakness of the flesh here is not physical tiredness. It's complacency and carelessness about the purposes of God. And how does he know that is what the problem is? Why is this the phrase that has come to his mind right now? Because that is exactly what he has been doing during these three anxious hours of prayer, using his willing spirit to overcome the weakness of the flesh. There's a reference to this in the book of Hebrews. In chapter 4, verse 13, it says, verse 15, of Hebrews chapter 4, we do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weaknesses. But we have one who has been tempted in every way that we are, yet he did not sin. And that is sometimes taken to mean that Jesus is a wee bit soft in sin. That when we get it wrong, Jesus kind of sighs lovingly over us and gives us a wee pat on the back and sends us in the way and says, well, what can you expect from humanity anyway? I've been where you are now and I know what it's like and I understand. I kind of expected it. But the point is not that at all. The point is that having been human and known weakness, he knows how not to sin. Having known weakness himself and not sinned, he now expects us to follow him. And so that's followed up in Hebrews chapter 5, verse 7. During the days of Jesus' life on earth, he offered up prayers and petitions with fervent cries and tears to the one who could save him from death. That's the Garden of Gethsemane. And he was heard because of his reverent submission. And so by implication, during our life on earth, when we're overcome with anxiety or struck down with weakness, then we too offer up prayers and petition with fervent cries and tears to the one who can save us from death, and we will be heard because of our reverent submission. So Jesus' anxiety in the garden is demonstrating his mere humanity, utterly indistinguishable from ours. The same tears, the same fears, the same pacing up and down, the flesh is weak. But not even anxious humanity is at liberty to sin. That reverent submission, which means letting God be God and do his job. Letting God be the one who knows best. Letting God be the one who reigns supreme. Letting God be the one who dictates lovingly and resolves eternally. That is what obedience demands. But it's also the reassurance that anxiety is seeking. If you're anxious, and as a result you behave erratically and you sin and make things worse, then worse is the only place it ends up. And a God who merely said, well, that's the best you can do, tough luck, would not be much of a gracious help to us. But a God who allows us in our anxiety to come to him and say, you are the Lord. And therefore, in spite of all I don't know, I do know what I need to know. Is a God who is good to his people. It's interesting that during all of this night of prayer, so far as we can tell from what is said, Jesus is not given either any way out of his anxiety. It's okay, Jesus, I'll make crucifixion a bit less painful than it was going to be. Or even any explanation for his future suffering, what he's anxious about. Probably he knew that already. He knew why it had to happen. What Jesus is reassured about here is that what he is anxious about is his Father's will. It's a horrible prospect. I really don't want it to happen. If there was any alternative at all available, I would seize it with open arms. Yes, please, anything else, Lord. But if it's what you want, that's good enough for me. Your will be done. And ultimately, if your palms are still sweating, anxiety is healed by faith. See, what's happening here is really dead simple. Jesus is saying in verse 38, keep watch with me, because there was a traitor on the loose. And there were plotters against him and his disciples. So out in a garden in the middle of the night when it's dark, anyone could creep up on him at any time. It made sense to set guards to avoid them being taken unexpectedly. So they're the guards to stop Jesus being captured, but they fall asleep. And in verse 44, Jesus is the one who actually sees the plotters coming. They were the watchmen, but he had to do their job for them. You keep watch. Here they come. And that, of course, is just the pattern of the whole of the Gospels. That it all comes down to Jesus in the end, what we have been given to do. And it was our duty to do, and our job and our allocation has to be done by Jesus. He is the one that all of this is about. And if you read Matthew's story, you see Jesus being isolated as the only one who matters. As the story moves towards its climax, there he is in chapters 23 and 24 and 25, having ridden into Jerusalem on the back of a donkey with palm branch waving crowds, teaching in the temple, being feted by the crowds, absolutely surrounded by people. What a glorious feeling it must have been to see all these supporters. And even at the start of chapter 26, although he's withdrawn in verse 6 to dinner in Bethany, he's sitting with a wide circle of friends who are chatting and supporting and talking with him, and one of them even anoints him with perfume. And even in verse 20, where we started last week, he's having dinner again, although this time, admittedly, he's down to just 12 disciples. But they're still in the hustle and the bustle in the midst of a city at festival time, and there's a lot going on. And then in verse 30, those disciples and Jesus walk together outside to the isolation of the Mount of Olives. And in verse 36, most of the disciples are left behind, and it's only four men who walk forwards. And in verse 39, even Peter and James and John are distanced, and going a little further, he fell with his face to the ground and prayed, and he's on his own. And there was nowhere any more remote to go, and no one else left to leave behind. He is utterly the only one left. And of course, the irony is that he is only here because of those three a few yards away, and those other eight or nine further down the line, and those crowds who gathered around him in Jerusalem, and the ones who waved their palm branches. It's because of all of them that this one alone has to be here. And the cup of suffering he sees before him is not just the pain of crucifixion, because gruesome as that was, the horrible reality is that many hundreds of Roman victims suffered that torture. But the pain in the cup he sees is the burden of the sins of all those people who've left him, and who can't come this far with him, and who, because of whom he is alone. It's not just the disciples' job of keeping watch he has to do for them, but all of ours as well. Because only by him can his Father's will be done. And alone in the garden with his Father, he faces the prospect that because of our sin, even his Father will abandon him. And the isolation is complete in chapter 27, verse 46. My God, my God, why have you forsaken me? So anxiety is not the problem. Complacency is. Human flesh is not the problem. Sin is. But anxiety awakened by the shame of sin, disturbed, troubled, restless, makes peace in the Garden of Gethsemane, where one of us, instead of us, sees the cross that lies ahead of us and does not flinch. And so, by faith, the Father's will is done. And I pray that he would follow with his blessing the reading and the preaching of his word.